Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was born in Port of Spain, Trinidad, and educated in the UK. She's the author of 6 books, 5 novels, and a memoir. 3 of her award-winning novels are set in Trinidad and the Caribbean region. She's a lecturer at the Manchester Writing School at Manchester Metropolitan University, and she divides her time between the East End of London and Port of Spain, where she also teaches creative writing. Monique Roffey, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you.
So, Trinidad, but from British parents?
My father was an Englishman, an English colonial who came at the end of the colonial era. And mum was born in Egypt, actually, and her family background are very mixed, sort of Maltese, Lebanese, Italian, French. So mummy comes from the Mediterranean, pre-war, very different society. And they met out there. Went back, mum thought she was going back to be a British housewife and live in northwest London. And dad got, he said, not really, no, we're going to the Caribbean. I've got a job in Trinidad. And that was 60 years ago. They're still there. Yeah.
And so essentially you grew up as a white West Indian.
Yep.
So in terms of race and feeling other, because I know that alienation is a theme that runs through many of your books. Mm. I mean, that must have been tremendously informative.
Yes. And it continues to be, actually. White people who are Creole, white Caribbean people are in the minority in terms of numbers. And yet there's a real complexity behind that because, of course, they're also associated with the dominant economic system. Not all white Caribbean people are a plantocracy and are part of the planter system. But I would say enough for it to be, you know, to associate Caribbean whiteness with the plantocracy. It's very complex.
And with privilege.
Yeah, with privilege and money and land and all of it, yeah. Mm.
And so would you say, as there is in Africa, that there is a certain amount of resentment then?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So most white Creoles, you know, they don't have a second passport. They don't have anywhere else to live. So they do live in a society whereby, you know, their ancestry are part of a major problem, crime, you know, criminal background, etc., etc. And so it's an uncomfortable space for most white Caribbean people. And I guess we would all say something different. I mean, I've talked about this quite a lot. I feel very different to perhaps my brother's wife, for example, who lives there. And I've been socialised out of the system and come back with very different ideas. Consider myself a socialist. It's definitely something that is you can't not be conscious of.
You were actually sent back to the UK to school.
Mm, yeah.
And so that was quite difficult, I imagine, leaving home.
Yep. At 13, with a big bunch of curly hair and a Creole accent and, you know, very different. It's the Jean Rhys story. It's you know, you come here and you're white. You speak with a clearly Caribbean voice. People don't know what to make of you. Yeah,
very difficult. And I know that those are some of the themes that you've explored in your book, White Woman on a Green Bicycle. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that a little bit more further on. Just tell me about your writing, though, because you started very early on. I mean, you were scribbling on anything you could reach.
Yeah. So, I mean, I always say it was a habit that became a job. So I've been writing from the word go from as a kid. I was writing, you know, graffitiing the walls, diaries, English at school was my favourite subject. Was a journalist from the age of 20 to 30. I worked in newspapers and magazines. And I quickly sort of got very bored of the whole newspaper thing. I didn't really know where to go with it after, you know, I was a feature writer for The Independent at one point, freelanced. And I just got going. I was least likely to succeed, you know. But I got a writer's degree at UEA. I got third. Classically a great degree, all, you know, lots of well-known writers get a third, slacker, reader, you know, idler. And then I just started writing, you know. I mean, recently I've started drawing and it's the same thing. I can see it really maps on to how I started writing, you know, least likely to succeed, had a go, sure enough, stuck at it, started writing, had things to say, and it all happened.
So I know that you now teach creative writing and I wonder how valuable that was to you as a student to be taught to write.
I mean, I am a product of this new system that didn't exist 20 years ago, which is the MA, PhD. So I've had an awful lot of mentoring. early on, and I think it was critical to me being formed as a writer, and I'm a real flag waver for that system. And I actually get quite pissed off when I hear certain writers, usually male, criticise it. I mean, I'm not going to mention any names, but so many well-known male writers think it's a bogus system. It's absolutely not. I was talking to some friends last night. I know I can help almost anybody who would like to write. There are so many things you really need to think about. And unless you think about it, you're just going to stumble out there.
And in terms of being a mentor, is there a danger then for the person being mentored to start sort of channeling that voice? Is there any kind of resignation of your own individuality?
No, I don't think it's possible to plagiarise creatively. I think everybody comes at it with their own aesthetic, their own reading, their own way of speaking. So your writing voice is the same as how you walk, what you might wear. Everyone's so unique. It's a chance to express your voice. I mean, you know, they say there's only, you know, seven basic plots, etc. But millions of filters which are unique, which is the voice of every writer, yeah.
So your route to publication initially, talk me through that.
Quite straightforward, really. I was very lucky. I did, you know, I was writing. I went and did an MA in creative writing at Lancaster University. I was writing a novel on my MA. An agent visited us. And those were the days before social media, before we had email. I had email. But, you know, you would get a letter from an agent and you would write a letter back and post it. And so I met this agent, and I remember I was my first novel is very magical, real, like a lot of my work. And he sort of wrote to me and said, well, I hear you're good. You know, you're one of the good ones in the group. But I'm afraid magical realism isn't very commercial, isn't very sellable. And I remember writing back to him, and he's a well-known agent. And I said, I disagree with you. I think all good writing is sellable. And I sort of think, oh my God, you know, that's the wrong. I would never advise an emerging writer to argue with an agent, you know. But I was argumentative from the start, and also pitched my own self. I mean, I have been a very uncompromising about sales and, you know, commerciality, and that's not why I wanted to write. I wanted to write to be me. I don't care. I don't write genre fiction. So if you're pitching at a literary career, I think from the start I knew that I wanted to be completely myself and write what I wanted to write, and that I come from this difficult place, and I have difficult positioning, none of my books are going to be easy, etc. I'm a magical realist, it's all going to be difficult.
Well, let's talk about your first book then. Tell me about that.
My first book, called Sundog, I still like it. I mean, I think I've developed as a writer so much beyond that book. I don't disown it, and I'm still proud of it. So when I was 30, I was seriously ill with an autoimmune illness, ended up in hospital for a long time at the National, couldn't walk for a couple of years. So Sundog is really quite an autobiographical debut about somebody who heals from inside out. And it's a simple concept where, as the healing takes place, there's a kind of manifestation of pure oneness with this person's environment. So August wakes up one morning, something's wrong, but in fact something's right. And so the seasons start manifesting bodily. And as he progresses and finds out more about who he is and who his father is and the real story, he becomes well. So it's a kind of, there's an autobiographical element there.
Do you think, I mean, most writers' first books are semi-autobiographical?
Yeah, and I think that's not a bad thing, and get it out of your system. In fact, I would say a lot of my body of work has to do with me and what I know. I now teach up north in Manchester, and a lot of them are sort of writing about wizards and, you know, and sort of trilogies, intergalactic trilogies, before they've even mastered craft, really. And I'm saying, you know, what about the North? What about literature coming out of your backyard and your hometown? They don't seem to be that interested. And I'm like, it is interesting. I am interested. I can't write. I'm not going to write a novel set in Manchester or anywhere north of Manchester, and it's your turf. So I think, you know, yes, write what you know initially.
And of course, White Woman on a Green Bicycle was that too.
Very much about my family, my mum and dad, and their arrival into the Caribbean in the 50s and beyond, yeah, and why they stayed.
Why did they stay?
Well, that's a good question. They couldn't really get away. There was all sorts of economic reasons why they couldn't leave. They had actually stayed a long time, built a house, bought land. They'd actually started to sort of do well out there, and then there was a sort of downturn, and sort of in the 70s it was very hard for them to sell up and go. And also my father loved it, and he just made loads of, he made it hard for mum. If mum wanted to go, she'd have to have gone on her own, really. Dad died there, you know, he's never going to leave. Mm. He said, what do you want me to go back to? Do you want me to go back to sort of Walton-on-Thames and commuting? Do you want me to still keep working 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week? Is that what you want me to do? Because you don't like it here.
House of Ashes was written about a very politically turbulent time.
Trinidad has famously had two uprisings, one a political black power, anti sort of black on black power revolution in the 70s. And then in 1990, we had a kind of coup, a coup d'etat, or an attempted coup d'etat, and it lasted 6 days, by a man who's still very much around, who is the leader, Abu Bakr, of a small militant Muslim group. And there are very few Muslims in the Caribbean, in Trinidad. Yes, there are mosques, but it's not, you know, the Caribbean is very Christian and very, you know, Baptist and very Hindu, but it's particularly Trinidad. So it was a small group of radicalized Muslims who had been plotting to take over. He was a powerful man anyway, and people just hadn't kept an eye on him, or maybe they had, or there's all sorts of stories. It's one of those rat's nest stories. And I really wanted to write about it because it hadn't been tackled. And I used to be in psychoanalysis for years, and I remember talking to my shrink and saying, you know, this is quite dangerous, you know. I talked it through with my shrink for a long time. And then when I thought, yeah, I'm going to do this, you know, 20-odd years later, the government, because a minister in the current government had been held captive, there was a commission of inquiry where, you know, about 100 witnesses still alive were called in to give testimony. It was all online. So as I had decided to write about this, I was suddenly given this amazing resource and people coming into court. I was able to go to court and listen to witness testimonies. I was able to track people down and be able to talk to people. I mean, amazing. So I went ahead with it, and it's my offering about this situation. And I really hope that other people will start, and particularly people. So I also teach creative writing in Trinidad. And a young woman came in to one of my groups and said, you know, I'm part of that group. And she needs to be writing about it as well as an insider. So I'm hoping, it's been a very taboo subject because the ringleader is still very much alive. And so God knows, you know, I did something that other people might think is rash, or I've got the privilege of not living there, so I've got distance. But I've still got family who live there. So for me, it was an important creative challenge. It was an important thing to write about. You know, the minute something's been left alone, too taboo, my radar, my instincts just sort of go, no. Everything's writable. There's no sacred cows, really. I'm not scared of you. And he's read it. You know, people in that organization are aware of my book. I mean, my book isn't really particularly critical of Islam or critical of Muslims, you know.
What it does do is it absolutely gives one the feeling of fear. You describe that feeling in that room where all these people are held captive. I mean, it's incredibly powerful. And I also thought, very, very brave of you to write. I know that you were nervous around publication of what the reaction would be, and particularly really for your own and your family's safety too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I was. And well, we've all survived. I mean, and it was the summer of 2014 when that book came out. And it was that awful summer where that jihadi John was beheading people in the desert. It was all happening exactly around publication. And I remember thinking, good grief, you just can't make this up. And, you know, the zeitgeist was in the air as well. But it is a book about terror, and it's a book about captivity. And also they shot the prime minister at the time. And it's that sort of Parsifal myth, where one of the young gunmen gets wounded in the groin and also discovers later spirituality. And, you know, there's something I'm doing there with the old king and the wasteland, and, you know, which is so like exactly what happened. Mm. The prime minister then, you know, retired, disappeared from public life, was seriously wounded, couldn't walk again, etc., etc. So confidence of the country was shaken. The whole city was laid waste, you know, Port of Spain was on fire, looted, sacked, ransacked. And, you know, legal system really didn't redress the crime that was committed. And then there was a terrible crime for about 10 years afterwards. All these people who were locked up were freed, and, you know, So there was a loss of confidence somewhere in justice, in government. The ramifications of that coup is sort of, you can still feel it today. This man just walks around, you know. Yeah. He's free, he's a free man.
As you say, you've never been one to dodge taboos. So let's talk about sex. Let's start, though, with a relationship. Now, I know that you lived with a writer for a long time, and in a way that must have been quite useful for your own writing, was it?
Well, I was just actually talking about this relationship last night to some girlfriends. I was much younger than I am now, and I really, really, really wanted to be an author, a writer. And he was a little bit older, a little bit ahead of me. And he had, I mean, he was incredibly influential. And so that's helpful. I mean, I don't think either of us actually pulled any strings for each other or caused, or, you know, were able to sort of literally help each other with contacts and phone numbers in that respect. But I would say, you know, we were together for, what, 6 or 7 years in my, well, I started out. And incredibly influential to have that kind of, whether you like it or not, I mean, I believe in some way there was a mentoring thing going on and there was a discipline that he already had that I was learning to acquire. And, you know, I'll always credit that relationship for being extremely important to how I acquired my own writing habits, yeah.
And it also prompted you to write about sex. It came to a horrible end.
Well, these things do, you know. Relationships are complicated. I was younger, you know, sex is a hard thing to talk about. Our sex life was, you know, it wasn't happening for all sorts of reasons that at the time was very difficult to talk about. And I do see, you know, this is a common problem within monogamy, within marriage, within all sorts of long-term relationships. And I know that that sexual energy's got to go somewhere, hasn't it? It usually goes out into couples who aren't happy sexually, you know, are very open to infidelity, you know. So infidelity crept in. I mean, again, I was such a young, much younger woman. It was a shocking way of ending a relationship.
You got a letter from the other woman.
Yeah, yeah, more than a letter. So a package from her to approve what was going on, which is, again, you know, really unskillful, wrong-footed, wrong-minded, you know, one woman trying to hurt somebody in order to prove her status. And in fact, it was just a, it's just a terrible thing to do to anyone, really. So, I mean, I've learned a lot over time, over, you know, power struggles, triangles, relationships. And my mother at the time said to me, she said, you know, I'll give you 2 years and you'll be back on your feet. And it's taken 10, you know, it's taken a long time and it's been part of my creative output as well. And it's also been part of what I've been thinking about and studying and researching and made my business to think about.
Because it did send you off on a journey of sexual discovery, which you document in your book with the kisses of his mouth. Tell us about that.
Again, I looked down at my books that I've produced, and I've produced 2 books about sex. And I don't think I ever said to myself, I'm going to write about sex, that's going to be my thing. These books have kind of dripped out, particularly The Tryst, over a long period of time. I think after that relationship where the sex had been so tricky, I think I got to 40 and this had happened, this disaster. And then I thought to myself, well, you know what? Sex just hasn't been what I'd hoped it would be. You know, I had these ideas when I was 15 of what sex would be like. And it hadn't really happened. All the sort of, you know, Hollywood, you know, people having, you know, orgasming together and in unison. And I was like, something's just really hasn't worked. All these ideas that I had about sex, this relationship aside, you know, it hasn't been what I'd hoped it would be. So I threw myself into, initially very unconsciously, a kind of journey of exploration around sex and sexuality. And I would also say in the early days, this is over 10 years ago, pre-Tinder, there was this thing called Craigslist where you could find sex, no strings attached sex. And, you know, when I look back, I mean, you know, this was bargain basement dating site. And I know that there were very few women like me out there at the time looking for that kind of sex, offering it, you know. And I was doing it partly because I was demented, you know, with grief, shock, you name it, fury, numb and reckless wanting it. But also there's that writer thing. I mean, I think a lot of writers have that. Not just instinct for a story, but a fearlessness in the face of, you know, I want to do this. I've met so many writers who want more, you know, want a lot for themselves. And so I just started, I didn't have a mobile phone. I started dating men. And I knew that the minute I'd set myself up for these adventures and encounters, that I was taking notes. So the writer instinct was hand in hand with the woman who was also really interested in exploring my sexuality. Two things were happening at the same time for a long time, for a year or two.
There's lots of elements to this, but is that kind of sex? Do you think sometimes it can be a form of self-abuse when you have got to a point where you are unhappy, you're searching for something? And although sex, obviously, a joyous and wonderful thing in lots of respects, sometimes that kind of constant searching for new partners, could that be seen as kind of self-flagellation in a way?
This is just opens up it's a really interesting question, because something like Tinder, all sorts of fetish sites, all sorts of... When people just use sex without love to connect, and if you do it a lot, it can lead to an addiction, without a question of a doubt. I think so. And then it can distort, sex can just become sex. Abuse? Yeah, maybe. I mean, personally, I don't think I was abusing myself. I do write about one difficult encounter. Personally, I think I was really good at taking care of myself. And I was always in control, always the one who had more power. There were more men looking for someone like me than the other way around. But I do think that I have a big questions about Tinder. And this is because women, during a sex act, release more oxytocin than men. So something different happens to women during a sexual act. We open and we release love, a love chemical. Okay, and that is a scientific fact. And this happens to all women, including dedicated polyamorists and swingers. And so Tinder grew from Grindr, and I think that two men meeting for no strings attached sex is a different thing. It's different. They sort of handle it, get it, do it better. Whereas the male-female version of it, scenario, I have loads of questions about women, no matter how well-meaning and no matter how, I really want to do this. I still think, and in the morning, how do you feel? You've opened up, haven't you?
Yeah.
That
throws up a really interesting debate about how men and women write about sex. I mean, the book With the Kisses of His Mouth, very successful. Now The Tryst, absolutely storming the bestseller charts. Fantastic book, and we'll talk about that specifically in a moment. But it's a book very much written by a woman, and I wonder about that gender divide when people write about sex.
Well, I wonder if men don't have this release of love. This is a common scenario. Man and woman get it together, get it on, spend the night together, have a wonderfully sexy encounter. In the morning, man thinks, oh, that was nice. And woman thinks, I'm in love. Mm-hmm. I've opened. I love you. And that's a huge imbalance. And so, of course, that's going to impact on our point of view when we come to writing about sex.
Mm. Writing about sex itself is very difficult, and it's hard not to kind of get corny and use all of the thrustings and grindings and all the rest of it. But you've managed in The Tryst to write this incredibly erotic book.
Thank you. I think that it's a combination of my imagination, which tends to be, and my style of writing, which is this tendency towards the magical real, but also this enormous amount of experience that I managed to pack in over 10 years. So there's lots of things in the book that I've drawn on from life. I talk about, Father Joseph and the woman in the yurt and Zohar Blumstein and stripping and all these things that she can do. And these are all things that either I've done or I've seen or I've met people I know. So the book is informed by my sexual journey. I could not have written that book at 35 before I had gone out there into the world, into these marginal spaces, into these liminal spaces, into the sex clubs and the caverns and all these places that I've been to. So I've kind of it is imbued and informed with, it's like writing from life. And I think, where sex gets, where bad sex arises is when someone's just sort of writing some projection or fantasy or something they don't know about, then all writing falls flat. Mm. All writing becomes cliched. So writing good sex is like writing good any scene, any type of drama scene. Write what you know. So I have had, a lot of interesting. I've been to the buffet.
That's fantastic. Yeah. The Trist actually sold twice because the first publisher got cold feet because it was so out there.
Yeah, sure. And so it has a story. I keep thinking this book just wanted to be in the world whether I wanted it to or not. So initially I was with Simon & Schuster for about 12 years and I'd published all my books with them and I'd survived three different editors and one editor had been very successful. We were a sort of dream team. And she's now very famous and was picked off and headhunted and now the head of Picador. You know, possibly, well, I should have gone with her then and there. But anyway, stuck it out. And so a new editor came along and, you know, the chemistry or the relationship wasn't as strong or as empathetic. We just didn't hit it off. And we worked on a book together and then we worked on House of Ashes together and she'd bought The Trist and we just hadn't really clicked. And she completely knew that she needed to be... She'd bought The Trist, but she also needed to know, I'm sure, that a book like this, she would have to be behind 100%. And I think, cold feet, you know, I just can't do this with you. And I was like, okay. And then I have a fantastic agent, Isabel Dixon, and she's like, I'll sell it. We'll do it. We'll go out there again. And we have. And everything... And look at the cover, you know. So the Dodo Inc., who are amazing... You know, they are dedicated to not just publishing edgy, difficult fiction, but in producing books that look like a piece of art. And they went to a fantastic designer in New York, Rodrigo Corral, who, like, read The Trist and he agreed that he would do a cover for The Trist for, like, next to nothing. And now we have this really sort of slick, Hitchcockian... Because I was said to her, I'd also said I wanted it to look really 70s like Lolita did, you know, when it came out or, like, you know... Fear of Flying and Erica Jong kind of book. I wanted it to look really 70s and this is what we've got. And we went and he had several different designs and that was the riskiest one. And we said, oh yeah, let's do it. It looks beautiful and I'm so thrilled with what they've done. And it's perfect now. I love the way it looks. And
people love the way it reads. I mean, it's now in its second printing. Did you think it would do that well?
Yes, we did. We were like, we know this is going to be okay. The baby's going to take care of itself. I mean, it's a small success. I mean, it's not printing tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of copies all over the... But in terms of an indie press and what it's doing, it's performing. Yeah, and the big shop, the big chains have taken orders now and it's in WH Smith at the moment on promo. Buy one, get one free. That's great for an indie press. Charing Cross Foils have championed it, front of house. It's in Waterstones. So for a little indie press...
It's brilliant.
It's being taken seriously by the bigger shops and the indies. It's selling.
Monique, what does this mean for your future as a writer? Are you a sex writer now?
No, but... Well, actually, I'm a novelist and I like to take risks and I've got another Caribbean novel with my agent at the moment. But because this has happened in a very... unplanned way, but it's happened that I've written two sex books. I reckon there'll be a third, yeah.
Monique Ruffey, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
The Trist is published by Dodo Inc. and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Sam Impey, George McDonough and Hunter Charlton. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.